push notifications and set up. So if they're looking for a particular strain, or they're looking for a potential THC content, or they're looking for a certain deal in general that's near them, it would be notified. They'd be push notified so they could be able to find that.
So is this some kind of a subscription thing where people pay so much to kind of be a part of that?
Yeah, so the dispensaries will pay a small monthly fee to be able to advertise, which will be able to push their deals through to the consumers. The consumers, it's a free download. They'll be able to use it for free. Anytime they reserve the right to grab that deal, that fire sale, it will cost them a credit, and credits cost a dollar. So if you are saving 15 to 50% on products and you use a credit to grab that deal, that will give you 24 hours to go to the dispensary and pick it up.
And once again, The name of the app is Fire Sale?
Fire Sale, yep.
And they get the actual URL for that is
firexsale.com. So FIREXSALE.com.
Damian Payne, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us. Talk to you soon.
Well, Amy, it's been quite a month, and next month is going to probably be the same.
Well, it has been a very exciting month, and I can't even believe it's the end of the year already.
All right, Amy.
Until next month, on the fourth Friday, I'm Amy Paradotta.
And I'm Ed Melnick, wishing you all the best.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from All Classical Portland, presenting Mark O'Connor's An Appalachian Christmas, featuring the O'Connor Band and guest Nancy Ives, Wednesday, December 14th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. An Appalachian Christmas features seasonal carols infused with bluegrass, folk, and Americana on banjos, fiddles, mandolin, and upright bass. A holiday tradition for Portlanders, tickets at allclassical.org. And from Seattle Theater Group, presenting comedian Tig Notaro performing at Revolution Hall Friday, December 16th. Tickets are still available for her 10:30 performance and more. More information for Tig Notaro on December 16th can be found at revolutionhall.com. And from Portland Saturday Market, open weekends and daily December 17th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute, offering handmade gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest, and is located in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses Radio, feminist news and public affairs, on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have fun. I'm your host tonight, Cheryl Green. Our engineer is Sam. And tonight I'm airing another episode from my own podcast archives, talking to Sabine Rear and Ariana Werner. I'll let you know more about them in a minute. First, a quick plug for the Bread and Roses Collective. If you're feeling like you've been hearing my voice on this show a lot lately, that's because you have. We're in the middle of changing a lot of the membership of the collective, and it's the most perfect time to consider joining us. Bread and Roses is wonderful for women, gender nonconforming, and non-binary activists and storytellers who want to get on the air. This is a space where you can join a loving community and also learn skills around all the magic of radio. We like doing skill shares, creating accessible spaces, and developing a place where we can challenge and dismantle hierarchy, hate, and the limitations of white feminism. Please be in touch if you want to learn more or join the collective, and I'll remind you again at the end of tonight's show. Please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.org or reach out to us at breadandroses@kboo.org to get engaged with our radio activism collective. Now let's jump over to my interview with Sabine and Ariana, recorded earlier this summer, and there will be a transcript of this episode on KBOO's website under Bread and Roses for tonight's episode. Today, I'm talking to two people who admire so much as artists, friends, and mentors, Sabine Rear, a blind illustratrix, and Ariana Warner, who has invisible disabilities and creates experiential arts events. Even though they have a ton in common, and they were at Portland State University at the same time, they'd never met before. That just had to change. Sabine joined me here in Portland to record, but Ariana had just moved to California about 1 minute before we were going to record. Fortunately, we caught up with her on Skype the night before she started a brand new full-time job. Hopefully, recording didn't steal any spoons she'd need the next morning starting her job. And if you heard that last sentence and wondered whether Ariana now works in a cutlery factory or why she'd need to bring more than one spoon to work on her first day, please go check out The Spoon Theory, a staple reading within sick, disabled, chronically ill, and neurodivergent communities. Many of us media makers have written and spoken tons about disability representation in TV and movies. A lot of what we say centers around the odd absence of disability, and when it is there, it's usually non-disabled people playing disabled characters, and they're nearly always white, cis, and straight. Often, disability shows up as something to fear, or as an opportunity to teach a cheerful, after-school special, once-off lesson to non-disabled people about pluckiness, keeping their chins up, and other supposedly inspiring but flat ideas. You do also sometimes see it in sci-fi, but not nearly enough. And it used to be a part of Star Trek, but oops, that didn't last. But one place disability shows up a ton is in superhero comics, though it hardly ever gets talked about by actually disabled people. I encourage you to look into other comics and zines created from and within disability community. For instance, E.T. Russian. Roz Alexander Kasparik's comic book called Recall and Given, and George's Dumb Project, near and dear to my heart because of my own voice disorder, Cynthia Nicole's Damaged Mentality zine, near and dear to my heart because of my brain injury, and oh gosh, so many more. Some of them have disabled superheroes, and many of them are using the comic form to bring up social, political, identity, and medical topics in very innovative, non-super ways. I am so excited. I cannot tell you. I'm here with the Crip Comics. What's the word?
I'm going for another C word. Yeah, but I the can't Crip Comics. Get there.
Well, I want to say connoisseurs, but you're not just connoisseurs of Crip Comics. You're creator. Creators. I'm here with two outrageously amazing Crip Comics creators, yeah. Sabine and Ariana.
I'm Sabine Rear. I make comics and zines. I've been working on them since I finished my bachelor's at Portland State and needed something to siphon all of my new academic feelings and thoughts into, to avoid the glowering void. my project right now that I'm most focused on is a series of conversations I'm having with other Crips who ride the bus in Portland. I'm sitting down with folks for about an hour and talking about the bus, their workarounds, their experiences, and what is sort of uniquely scary, cool, complicated about the sort of public-private space of the bus as a visible or not visible disabled person. And I'm illustrating those conversations, and then there'll be a multimedia component where folks provide audio description. Since I'm a blind lady and I am aware of the really cute conundrum of making visual art as a blind person.
So I'm Ariana Warner. I am a recent graduate of the Art and Social Practice MFA program at Portland State University. And I do work that kind of is at the intersection of disability studies and building communities. And a part of that, I'm in the process of creating the Institute for Crip Comics. And so it's kind of a hub for all things comics involving disabilities and looking at them from a disability studies perspective. And there's a couple different branches of that that is actively engaging those comic books, whether it's in the creation of it and the stories of having a disability experience, and then also into how that transforms into educational materials for accessible media to teach disability studies discourse.
All right. More than anything, I wanted to interview the two of you together to listen to you two talk about the way that you are taking your own disability experience and not being inspirational, not being focused on cures and medicine, but on celebrating lived experiences and challenging ableism through comics. All right, go. You said Crip early on that the...
Okay, yeah. Crip is like new, exciting language for me. I guess Crip and disability studies are really connected for me. I graduated from Portland State with my BA. I spent the last couple years of my BA just trying to shoehorn disability studies into a space that it didn't exist. Portland State has interest, but definitely no infrastructure or faculty or real, not a lot of base of knowledge. And that is a really cool, scrappy experience, I think, to get to have, is to place Crips where they are not invited. And so I came to Crip, I think, in an academic space, and it felt super exciting to me because I feel very aggressive about the way I talk about my disability. And specifically, partway through getting my BA, I met another blind adult, which I very rarely got to do at the time, who was like, why do you call yourself visually impaired? Like, that's not necessary. Like, you could just call yourself blind and use like whatever language you want. Like, I'm sure people are referring to you as visually impaired in your experience with medical professionals, but that's not your only option. And I think that is a choice that I get questioned on all the time, because the language around presenting or not presenting Crip means it's considered a compliment to say, like, I can't tell that you're blind. Like, thank you. So those two initially are wrapped up in each other in an academic space. And then Crip, I think when you take it out into the world, it feels aggressive, it feels transgressive, and it feels like also very playful. And so linguistically, I really like dancing around that. And it's new. It's new for lots of folks who haven't thought of themselves as being a part of a radical and politicized community. And having a chance to play with language in that way, I think, is really exciting.
I'm so intrigued that you came to Crip in an academic space like disability studies, but you also said politicized and radical. And, you know, a lot of times those two don't really go together. So I'm excited that you did find them together. That's very nice. Yes. So, Ariana, you did art in an academic space around disability, too.
Absolutely. Kind of reflecting or mirroring what Sabine was saying about how at Portland State there's no disability studies. I mean, there's not really a community around disability or the disability experience. And for me, it's such an integral part of my life of having this invisible disability. And I'm somebody who constantly needs to find ways to explain my situation to other people. And I don't have to. I'm being questioned though constantly about like, oh, well, why can you do this and not do this? What is this? And A, it's none of your business. And B, I try to just do it on my own terms to be able to express myself. And so that's where my art practice came involved with art and social practice of taking a personal private experience and making it public in a way that I feel comfortable that I can alter or direct in a certain way so that it's not asking really inappropriate questions about my body. It's more about the artwork and about how it can bring people together. And so for me, thinking about disability studies and being really interested and passionate about learning more about disability culture and the history of disability, I try to find different ways to investigate that in a space that academically doesn't support that. And it's really hard when you are constantly faced with multiple most institutions, I would even say, that don't prioritize or even offer a disability site. So basically saying your history or your culture isn't worth us examining, isn't worth us having or investing in. It's not worthy. And so for me, it's hard. And so again, it goes back to CRIP and being really political in a way to be like, okay, well, even though you're not investing this, it's a priority for me. And so I'm going to make projects like the Institute for CRIP Comics, where I'm forcing you to think about disability. I'm doing it in a way that's integrating it into classes, into studies that are not focused on disability necessarily, but in a sneaky way, I'm making it about disability and having you experience and be more aware of what the disability experience is in America.
You talked about culture. I often think that that's one of the reasons that people don't want to deal with it, because they just can't even conceive that there's a culture around it. Like, oh, disability culture, you mean rehab? No.
So when there's this kind of confusion around what representation means and what, like, the concept of a CRIP culture existing is so contested and confusing on such a base level, I think that's where CRIP becomes really useful. It insists on using sort of confrontational language to demand space.
Yeah. And to demand accessible space, right? As Sabine, you mentioned that the storytellers in your comics project will also create the audio description. I'm really interested in accessibility, not as an end goal. We can't have social justice if there's no access, but it's not good enough to only have access.
Yeah. Thinking about being a blind person, making visual art, talking with some blind folks for this project and wanting them to be able to access this project in one way or another. I really like access materials as secret code.
Say more.
Right. So you go to the art museum and you listen to the guide for the blind, and it's the most basic garbage. Like, the painting is a square.
God.
And what I want is to go to the art museum and be trusted to have and want knowledge. And so I want to go to the museum and go to a Saul LeWitt show and have them share, like, Saul LeWitt is a modernist artist who moved away from painting things himself and left detailed instructions. I want information, and maybe even more information than is being offered to an able visitor. Apropos of just trusting that CRIPs are there because they want to be there, and that there is, like, value in providing access and space and information.
Ariana, you've also talked about access in terms of trust. Like, trust me, I actually do know what my body wants right now.
In the art world, when thinking about access, a lot of people tend, and this is a huge generalization, but a lot of people think of blind, visually impaired access, wheelchair access, and deaf and hard of hearing access as a kind of the big groups of figuring out how to make something accessible. It's really hard to have a conversation about how to make something accessible to somebody who has chronic pain or somebody who is neurodivergent. There's not always this structure of, oh, well, you just blank and it's accessible. And so those conversations get really difficult for people to grasp, I think, because you have to talk to the person and you have to, first of all, get comfortable enough at asking, okay, how can I support you to be able to experience this as much as you as an individual want to experience this? And how can we best make that happen? And I think if you don't even know that's a question to ask, it's just like, oh God, there's a person who has a disability and I don't want to say the wrong thing and all of these different things. And definitely when they attempt, even though they may have good intentions, coming up to somebody and being like, oh, I noticed that you're handicapped. Can I assist you in doing this? And they're like, oh my gosh, there's so many issues with what you just said. And so I think that there needs to be more conversations and making people feel more comfortable to ask questions about access for everyone as a thing that you ask anybody, because not all disabilities are visible. And so if somebody needs to experience painting, they need to sit on the bench or whatever, even though you might look like a very able-bodied, healthy 26-year-old, you know, they're going to give the chair to like the 70-year-old man who can't, you know, who is walking by, and they're going to say, oh, here, you can sit here. But they're not going to ask me, say that, like, I can sit there necessarily. I think there's a lot of education that needs to happen about access. And then also just offering things in multiple ways for people to interact or engage with a piece. And then people can pick whatever they want. For the Institute for Crip Comics, for example, you know, we're going to have all these comic books and all these artists are part of this collective. How do we make these comic books accessible? Okay, well, we could have 30 different versions of comic books, but that's not the point. The point is that everybody can access the same comic book in multiple ways. And so figuring out how all these puzzle pieces kind of fit together has been really exciting. And I've worked with a couple different people that create accessible material in order to jumpstart making comic books more accessible for people with disabilities.
Yeah. So you're working with other people. Have you met my friend Sabine Rear, who also does comics?
That was a great advertisement for me. But what I'm thinking about as you say that is that I find access materials the most creative and helpful when other disabled people are making them. Mm-hmm. That's a part of Crip community that I find really exciting. And when I say Crip community, that's like a really new concept for me. I think my first time being in a room of almost exclusively disabled people was when Cheryl and I met, and I found out I'd really hurt your feelings at that conference in Seattle. And then we worked that out and we both cried and now we're friends.
It was the most beautiful. I need to let you finish your story, but you taught me so much. Like, that was the biggest learning experience for me around grace and forgiveness. Oh my God, that was, excuse me, please finish your story.
But the root of that experience, right, was about how I had not known how to out myself between disabled people. And how to do that, and why it was really important was that I was asked to interview Cheryl for a well-meaning magazine, and I did a bad job. I didn't clarify the subject position I was coming from because I wasn't at the point where I understood that Crip is a subject position and it's always going to be the one I operate from. And so I didn't out myself and I didn't clarify, and I sent some very blasé questions that Cheryl answered, but it was clearly, it did not go well. And I, as soon as I got the answers back, I knew it didn't go well. But no one in my office really got that, so it just went into the world.
I did not realize that's how it happened.
Oh yeah,
because when I met you, you were so cryptastic and embracing.
I was in this new world of working at a magazine where I was kind of, I think, deferent to the space I was in, and just didn't know how to crip it up.
And I didn't know how to be generous with someone who's not yet speaking the language that I would want them to be speaking, which is what you taught me in that conversation about generosity. Well, if I didn't ask you the questions from the position you like, You don't actually have to be completely aggressive, and then we publish it. But yeah,
but I think we published it partially because it came out well. Because I think no matter how much of a dingus I appeared in the context of those questions, I think what happened was it was an opportunity for people to read an aggressively thoughtful response from Crip to poorly written questions. So this conference was my first experience in Crip community, and it was earth-shattering to be in a room full of people just actually asking those thoughtful questions about, you know, what do you need to engage with this? Do you even want to engage with this? How could I make this space work for you? But also, like, if we're sharing academic materials, if we're sharing a meal, how do I give you the space, respect, warmth that you want and need and deserve in the context of letting you experience what you want to get out of this academic space? And at the time I was working on a paper, and that was the first time I'd really gotten to share that with other disabled folks and really get a sense of like, oh, this is what the Crip community, you know, has for me in response to this work. That was the most valuable experience that I had never had before, because there's no space like that at Portland State, but also anywhere, right? And so carving out those spaces takes a ton of work. And I really commend the University of Washington for doing that work so consistently.
For me, as somebody who has developed a disability at a young age, as a teenager, learning about disability was something that was really hard to access for me.
Yes.
The community that I grew up in, I think going into a space that's a Crip space and offering up my experience and my opinions on that experience without the knowledge of other amazing Crip people and information and knowledge, it would be really difficult for me to not come off as somebody that doesn't know what they're talking about, or maybe somebody that projects ideas that are not in alignment with other Crip stories or experiences. My question is, how did you discover a space where you felt comfortable in exploring Crip theory or culture? And is it really about the individual self-investigating those things? Or is it about, like, if we offer those spaces, it allows people to think more deeply about what it means to be Crip?
I love that thought. I think both of those things are definitely viable ways to get there. And I think as long as you get there, right? But it is hard to go and test out your Crip body and theory on other Crips and say, like, here you go, you're welcome for me. I came to Crip through queer theory because I was playing around in queer theory and being queer and thinking, like, the queerest part of my body is being blind. And those things get tangled up in such interesting ways. And that was the most excited I'd ever felt in academia. And I think Crip theory and queer theory are some of the most playful, most sort of welcoming, but also high theory academic spaces that I've ever experienced. And so I started, you know, digging in academically and found this like total playland of like using language in ways that was funny and difficult and really aggressive and challenging. And I know there's some very alienating things about that and about the academy, but I found it so exciting. And it kind of let me into the secret code of art that I hadn't understood as being Crip or as being queer, and learning how to read things in that way that was really exciting. And so I think I went the way of trying it out academically, and trying it out academically in the context of the Portland State Women and Gender Studies Department, where people were like, I don't know what this is, cool. So I got to play in that way for a while before I really met a community. Which allowed me to put my foot in my mouth on paper a bunch of times before I really, you know, test drove being in a space that was really critically important to me that I do a good job being in that space. This year, I went to the same symposium at the University of Washington. This symposium has existed for 2 years. Both years, we've closed by, after hearing each other's academic work on crip theory and public space and gender.
Ariana, did you also face some of that, like, when you were in your MFA program, like, I don't know what that is, that crip disability stuff. Did people run with it the way Sabine was describing?
How do I answer this? I think that people definitely have their own place that they start from. And I think understanding that was really difficult for me, is that not everybody is going to start where either I am or where I would hope that they would be. And I think that there's definitely people that were more jumping on the bandwagon a little bit faster than others. And I think that it really comes back to that idea of, like, how much are you willing to invest in something that you don't feel a part of? Mm. And I think that was difficult to understand, that, okay, why should I make this accessible to people, even though that might not be the primary community that I'm engaging with? And so those are kind of really big hurdles from my perspective, to have people understand my practice. And so that's been something that I've consistently had to think about. Okay, well, how is the crip community going to perceive this project, and how can I engage with them and have this experience where everyone's coming together and it's accessible and awesome? And then on the other hand, having people who are able-bodied, or how sometimes I like to use the word temporarily able-bodied, to engage with a project that they have no investment in because they don't have that experience. Why should anybody else care about my experience? Like, how do I make them care about that? And why is that important? Is it important? And it comes out in different ways. Sometimes I'm like, well, you know, I'm just one person that has this experience, and it's not I don't have enough spoons to fight this battle right now. So I have to be more tactful with it. And then sometimes I'm in your face and, like, aggressive, crip, angry mama bear kind of person. And that gets me sometimes further, and sometimes that doesn't. It just makes me more angered and upset. And then I go crying to Cheryl being like, help me. I can't make sense of all of this. But at the end of the day, whether people are accepting and are invested or trying to understand, or they're not at all, and I'm dealing with whatever that may mean, it's been an experience that I've grown as an individual and as a crip, and as, you know, somebody who has many experiences and many identities, and learning from that and really investigating why I have these emotions about the way that situations happen.
If you're just tuning in, this is Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, your community radio station. I'm your host, Cheryl Green, and I'm talking to Sabine Rear and Ariana Warner about crip culture, community, and coming up soon in the conversation, crip comics. You're listening to 12 Tides by Star Over Blue. So there's an experience that I have, and I want to know if you two have it as well, and it's around credibility. So I think it's fair to say that at least at times, all three of us can pass as non-disabled in certain scenarios, in certain activities. In non-disability space, I have more credibility as someone who passes. Oh, you're one of the normal ones, so clearly you're smart and capable, and all the assumptions that go with non-disabled. And then if I'm in disability space and I'm passing, I lose credibility. Well, who the hell are you to come in here and talk? So do you two find with
passing or non-passing around disability or any other parts of your identities. Do you find that credibility issue?
Yes.
And yes. Yeah.
So I used to work at Portland State as the Inclusive Recreation Student Coordinator. So I was responsible for all the programs that are at Campus Recreation that are specifically geared towards being inclusive for people with disability with able-bodied people. And that opens up a whole can of worms as well in some ways. But I think what's interesting is that sometimes I became more credible about being knowledgeable about disability as this position title of somebody who works for the university and is in this role, rather than me as somebody who experiences disability on an everyday level. And it wasn't necessarily at Campus Recreation, but in other scenarios around campus, I was definitely seen more as an expert in this position rather than my personal experience. And I think that was something that was really hard for me to kind of negotiate or navigate. If I go into a department and I'm, you know, talking about disability studies and say, okay, I'm somebody that has a disability, I experience it in this, like in these ways, and this is the knowledge that I have from that. They're like, okay, cool, you're just like any of your other students, whatever. And then I go in and I say, well, I'm the student coordinator for Inclusive Recreation. Then all of a sudden it's like, oh, so you know what you're talking about. You are being paid to know these things, and that makes this information that you know as a student coordinator more credible than just being somebody who lives with it every single day.
Ugh. What about you, Sabine, around credibility and passing?
Oh, yeah, unequivocally, yes. For me, passing is still really, well, passing is always poignant. I was going to say, for me, passing is still very poignant. it hurts. Everything hurts. I have been blind all my life, but the cane is new to me, and I had a very super crip mentality growing up, so I was very resistant to learning tools. And at the same time, I think I was partially resistant because I was learning how to be blind from a sighted person.
Uh-huh.
A very kind and lovely sighted person. But that disconnect was not lost on me. So the cane is fairly new. And so now that transition from carrying or not carrying a cane, it's so clear to me that in public that's flipping and unflipping a switch in terms of how I'm perceived, and it is exactly that immediate. In an able-bodied space, I'm questioned on, you know, from how'd you cross that street to... So this is a great space for me to just complain.
Mm-hmm.
I got off the MAX and crossed the street. I'm covered in groceries. I'm literally growing groceries off of my limbs, and I'm just trying to get home. And a man stops me and is like, how'd you get across the street? And I was like, lots of practice. And he walks away, and I'm like, okay, I did it. I can go home now. He circles back to say, by the way, I'm really handsome. Ha 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 ha. I'm like, this is what we do. This is what we get to do with my time. This is what my time is for. It's for you, sir, white dude in your 2010 Buddhist retreat t-shirt.
Oh,
this is what we're doing.
And so he's interrogating you for your disabled body. He's presuming you're straight and that you want to hear about his looks.
Mm-hmm.
So many presuming that you...
That I want it. Because how could he be anything but charming? In disabled spaces, I'm aware of... How much space should I take up? I am able to do these things, not able to do these things. And I do start to test myself or perceive others as testing me in terms of, like, where do I rate on the crippy crip scale? Mm. And I think that actually has much more to do with me than it does with the people I am around. When I find myself doing that in crip spaces, I come away from it like, what are you doing? Like, nobody's watching you. So I feel much less policed in crip spaces. Mm-hmm. I feel very policed in public.
Mm-hmm. So let's come back to comic stuff. And if somebody could go back in time and read my mind and find that question that went away. Oh, yes. Okay.
Well, so that was going to be my question. I mean, it seems you're kind of creating a living archive, right? Of people sharing work, translating work, if you will, into accessible forms. And I love hearing from Crips, especially, like, what about comics as a medium works so well to address Crip subjects. And for me, not all of my work is Crip focused, but it's all about being disabled. I think that's just the deal for me. But yeah, but what about comics is such a useful medium.
Historically, you found comics in the daily, like the newspaper, and it was an accessible medium that was really easy to replicate and be able to distribute among the masses, everybody who bought a newspaper. People don't have to invest a lot in a comic book if they don't want to. It's, you know, $2 to $4 for one issue of a comic book. And it's, you know, typically short. You can finish it in one sitting. And so it's an accessible medium for people to have in their physical space. And I think that with it being a very visually based medium, it's kind of added some interesting, I wouldn't necessarily say challenges, but opportunity to find other ways to make comics themselves be as accessible in a non-visual format. And that's something that's been really exciting and interesting to me. Also, there's a huge culture around comic books. And so in order to be able to tap into a community that already exists to talk about issues that may not be at the front of people's minds, to talk about something that is very based on, like, your experience. And I think that what's also interesting is that you can use them as educational material. So, you know, a textbook is like hundreds of dollars sometimes, and it's written by some stuffy people in some room and, you know, 50,000 years ago, and they write this information and we're supposed to take their word for it. And I think with comic books, what's really nice is that you're able to have all these different experiences, all these different perspectives that can all kind of tell their own story and have their own light, but they're also part of this bigger narrative of disability studies and Crip culture. And that's something that has been really exciting to play with. And I'm super excited to start really making some headway with the ICC and just bringing artists and people with disabilities together and all people that love comic books and comic culture to really think about what it means to be somebody with a disability today in, you know, different lands and different places, imagined or not. And so, that's why I'm really excited about.
You were talking about how there are things that people don't want to talk about. And I know that comics, especially the more famous comic books, really actually tackle disability all the time. Now, one of many things that you two are bringing to this is that you're not non-disabled people drawing somebody in a wheelchair. You're bringing your own experiences. And I have heard people very excited about talking about queering comics and the queerness of comic stories and comic characters, sort of queering the mutantness of certain characters. But then even though there are so many characters with very obvious physical disabilities or impairments, these same comic connoisseurs and critics don't ever bring up disability. And it's so weird to me.
I think that comes from the same place where able-bodied folks are like, disability community, that's garbage. Like, how do you even get them all into the same room, you know? When I was a kid, I wanted to marry someone who was visibly disabled. I was so fixated on this thought that, like, I'm going to have this, like, hot person who's really visibly disabled so everyone will know that we're a power couple. Like, I don't think I had it fleshed out in that way in my mind, but I had, like, I was piqued by seeing like young people who I could identify as disabled, because I think as a kid, like, I was that blind girl where you're like, something's up, but I don't know, she's just running into stuff. Like, I wasn't being read the way I wanted, and I wanted that. Queer community is so solidified as desirable, at least queer to queer, that, like, of course you, and it's like, it's standard language, I think, now to queer things. Mm-hmm. To say, like, oh, Top Gun's super gay, and we love that. But to crip is, I think, more transgressive because it's not understood as a desirable subject position. And so even though you're looking at a comic where someone is in a wheelchair, it's the last thing you want to talk about because it's not read as a desirable subject position. It's a fatal character flaw or a metaphorical ability. I always hated Daredevil because he's a blind guy and his superpower is that he can jump like a sighted guy. Like, his superpower is just jumping and not running into things.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so something I've done as a part of doing research for the Institute for Crip Comics is I've gone into a lot of different comic book stores and have asked the owners and people that work there, and anyone who's in the store usually jumps in as well, and saying, okay, I'm doing research. Can you tell me anybody who is in any comic book, it doesn't matter what it is, fiction, nonfiction, whatever you have here, that has a disability? Every single one of them has said, oh, I've never thought about that.
What? How can you? And now what they're saying is, oh, moms love El Defo. That's like the one where you're like, are you a parent of a disabled child? Here you go, El Defo. Like, I'm glad it exists. And also, like, one does not count. Not just, we don't just,
No, so it's, I mean, there are characters who are, use wheelchairs, and but they're not identifying that as a person with a disability?
I'll stand there and just, like, wait. Because they'll be thinking and they're like, this is a great thing. Like, I feel like this challenge, and I feel as somebody who is a comic book lover, and I feel that I'm a comic book guru, so I should know. I should come up with these things. So they sit there, literally, I've been there for like 45 minutes, an hour, where they're like thinking of these names, and they always come up with Daredevil first. They come up with Batgirl, but then she is, what's her name?
Is it Barbara Gordon?
She gets shot, and then she's a wheelchair user.
Barbara, right?
Later.
Am I saying it wrong? Barbara, is that it? Is that a senator? Barbara Gordon, or no?
That's it. Barbara Gordon.
I was like, Barbara Jordan? No, Barbara Gordon.
Yeah, Barbara Gordon. And then, and so they go down this list, and like Professor X, you know, from the X-Men. And so they go down this list of all the obvious, like super obvious ones that are like the peak of comic book culture right now, or the most public or popular ones, I should say.
The most dude ones. The dudes. Yes.
And so it's been really interesting. And then it becomes this competition in there, and they totally like bro out and being like, oh, I can come up with more than you can. After they like finish getting all the obvious ones or the ones that they can think of, then they start projecting them on characters. So they're like, oh, well, you know, Deadpool, he's schizophrenic. No, he's OCD.
Oh, no,
he's this. And then it becomes this argument of like them deciding what disability he has, which I've never read the Deadpool series. So I don't know if it explicitly says anything in there about anything. And then they just go on about this, like, diagnosing this character. And I'm like, this is why I need to do this project.
Yes.
It's really interesting as somebody who's studying it, but on a level of, like, you thinking that this is totally okay for you to, like, diagnose somebody, if it doesn't say it at all in any of the books, then it's just kind of like, okay, this is getting really awkward. Change the subject.
Wow. Man, if I could have been a fly on the wall with my video camera and my
stick.
Yeah, something wrong.
There's something, something's not clicking for me, or like I have to explain this problematic behavior, so I'm going to read this way.
Mm-hmm.
And that switch makes me so uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, it's what you talked about it not being recognized as desirable, whereas those of us in CRIP community are like, I'm not finding what's undesirable here.
In the context of your question about mutants, it's offensive to say, like, the definition of mutation in this whole X-Men conversation, or like whatever mutant teen superhero conversation, there's so many, it's all CRIP language. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I think the adamant misrecognizing and disidentification with CRIPness on the part of people who are like, well, I want to see myself in these comic books. Like, yes. And there are explicit references being made here that might, for the first time, like, allow a disabled reader to see themselves in a comic book. And so don't touch that. Right. To put it down. Right. I have very little experience with superhero comics. As a blind lady, I try not to read comic books by men, because there are a lot of great comic books not by men. And I really don't like reading comic books that are in color, especially the way superhero comics look is just too much for me. The saturated, like, the pages are just too full. I know I'm missing tons of information. The print is too small, and I don't really think I need adaptive comic books necessarily. What I need is just to be the feeling of being able to pick up a book by an artist who set a page up in a way that I get is so satisfying to me. And so I've never really engaged with superhero comic books because they are all that, like, incredibly over-colored to me, like, visually overwhelming mess that I just can't parse. And I find that work that's made in black and white is much more legible to me. I can get, like, I can move around the page in a much, like, freer way, regardless of my blindness and how it's manifesting in terms of interacting with a visual object.
Mm-hmm. E.T. Russian.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah, their work is so fun good. For me to engage with. I totally love it.
It has those qualities you're talking about, but it's not like, oh, here's a watered-down comic because it's not super saturated and overfilled. It just is great as it is.
I think E.T.'s work is a really great example of what is really exciting to me about comics, which is that they, like animation, I think when it's really good, they provide a space to play with bodies and play with known forms and construct them in ways that are not understood as physically possible, physically probable, desirable, whatever. Like, it's a way to play with monsters and shapes and how unrecognizable can you make a recognizable body or object or form. And that kind of play is, to me, goes hand in hand with, like, CRIPness and a desirable CRIP body. And I get very excited about folks that are really willing to push those boundaries in, like, sort of constrained aesthetic spaces, like E.T.'s, like looking at a black and white comic and saying, like, I can read this and what's going on is bizarre, and is really using this space in a really effective way.
Also, what I love about E.T.'s work is that the comic book or the creation is this investigation, like, internal and external, and it's writing down that process, or it's getting that information down or that investigation down. And it's very much experimental and figuring out, okay, well, this works, but this doesn't work here, and that's okay. There's such a personal level of information in the work that is very easily communicated to somebody who's, you know, sitting down with the book or with comics or the zine and just flipping through it and, like, really investing in just a single page. And I think that's something that's really beautiful and is a great example of, you know, all amazing CRIP comics and information.
Yeah.
Ariana, I get really excited about archives, and I think they're, like, a necessary construction. We want them. It's how would you know if something is good if it's not in an archive? But I get so excited about other people rebuilding and editing and sort of setting boundaries around canons. That curatorial work is so exciting to me. And it's such a cool, living, ongoing process. And I'm so excited to know that you're doing it.
I am really adamant in, at this point in my life, saying that I'm an artist, but I do not draw or illustrate. And so it's really exciting for me as somebody who loves all things comic books and adding different narratives and pedagogy to comic books and specifically within education. I just think it's really interesting approaching a project like this where it's archiving and getting people together and building a community, even though there is a community of people making Crypt comics, but having a hub where these people can all get together and have conversations and works can interact with each other, and then taking that a step even further and using that material as curriculum or as information or educational material for people within universities or academic institutions. And so it's been really interesting to learn more about illustrators and comic creators and zine makers and the people that are actually making these stories or writing down their experiences. I do my part in bringing people together and archiving these things, and I'm really excited about interacting with everybody else and all the other artists. So, Sabine, you're amazing. I've checked out some of your work, and we'll definitely be having a conversation in the near future. But I'm super excited about all the things that you're doing and your articles, and it's really exciting to know that there's artists out there that are not afraid to put their experiences down and that are actively trying to engage with people around a subject matter that sometimes makes people feel uncomfortable, but it's doing the work to educate people and definitely doing it in your own terms, which I absolutely love.
That's so kind. That's so nice. And it's been so exciting to speak with you and to know that there are so many levels at which artistic collaboration happen. To come back to Access, like, Access materials give us the opportunity to make and remake the same work so many times and to really, I mean, to use the language of art and social practice, like, it is a social practice to make and remake art that we deem valuable, useful to our communities, important. I think that's so exciting. And you can find my work at michaelsabine.com.
You sell your zines in store-type stores, too,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My zine about ableist microaggressions is available for purchase at Powell's Books and Reading Frenzy in Portland.
I bought my copy at Reading Frenzy.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Wait, is that the one with the spoons bending on the cut?
Yes. People come up to me. Zine events are so stressful. I love making zines, but then you have to go be in public with whoever's in public, and they're like talking to you about your work. And like, I'm not embarrassed. I'm just embarrassed for whoever's going to ask me the wrong thing. That's mean. I'm mean. No, but none of my zines have cover text on them. They just have graphic images, and the piece about microaggressions just has spoons bending, which I think is great. And some people pick it up and totally get my secret code, which is always like, I love a secret code. But some people will be like, is this about telepathy? I'm like, oh man, witchy dude, we are not, I don't want to do this with you right now.
You just bent my spoon.
Ugh, my last one. And now it's just knives. We talk about knives all the time, too.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen my knife shirt, Ariana?
Yeah, I'm ordering mine as soon as I get my first paycheck.
Yeah, yes.
No more spoons, only knives left. Ugh. And Ariana, tell folks where they can find your work and your different projects.
You can find my work at arianawarner.com, and there'll be a website soon for the Institute for Crypt Comics, and it'll all be connected through my personal website. It'll be more updated in the near future, but yes, people can connect to the various websites from my personal artist page.
Outstanding.
This is why it's so important, because even with a new job that's a 40-hour week thing, it's really important to me that I continue my art practice, and doing things like this and doing interviews and talking with people gets me excited and keeps me going as soon as I have my head on straight and have kind of figured out my new way of using my spoons in, you know, the workplace, I think is something that's going to be really interesting. And so once I figure that out and where I can, you know, pull a couple spoons to reserve to work on my art practice, then I will be definitely contacting both of you. Yeah! It's going to be so good.
I'm so excited.
I simply cannot thank you two enough. I thought a star would be born as soon as you two started talking, and it was.
It was. Oh, it's such a cute star.
But I do genuinely thank you so much for making the time and coming out and doing this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Nice to meet you.
It was so good meeting you too.
Congratulations on your new space.
You have been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Thank you so much for listening. Many thanks again to our engineer Sam and our evening public affairs director, Lisa Loving. We always welcome new collective members. And if you're interested in joining us as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.org or reach out to us at breadandroses@kboo.org. You can connect with us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can access our podcasts and share feedback or show ideas. Like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses, and we are on Twitter at Bread Roses Radio. I'll leave you now with Interlude from Star Over Blue. Have a good night, everyone.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Buyer and Seller, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from November 25th through December 17th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland.